Show me the money.
This is the MoneyWeb Be a Better Investor podcast, picking the brains of professional investors on their investment strategies, successes, and mistakes. Your host, Rake Fanica.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Be a Better Investor podcast. My name is Rake van Niekerk, and in this podcast series, I speak to leading professional investors in South Africa. We speak about their investment journeys. We discuss how their investment strategies have changed over the years, and we also take a peek into their personal portfolios to see whether they practice what they preach. And the idea is to identify a few golden nuggets of wisdom to help amateur retail investors to become better investors. My guest today really doesn't need much introduction. It's Patrice Rousseau, and he's the Chief Investment Officer at Ashburton Investments. And before joining Ashburton in 2020, he was head of equities at Sanlam, and he was also a portfolio manager at Old Mutual Asset Management. He has an MSc in economics from the London School of Economics and Political Science. He has also an MBA from the University of Manchester, and he's a CA, and there are also a string of other qualifications on his CV. Patrice, thank you so much for your valuable time today. You have had a very interesting academic journey. You started off with economics, and then later you changed over to accounting, and then you moved over to investments, where you are still today. Tell us about this journey and the choices you've made.
Nice to speak to you, Rake, and to all the listeners. It is an interesting journey, but I think we need to go back. My parents were teachers, and I come from a household where I was always surrounded by books, and I was always very curious about the world. And I think I've learned from my father, who was a Greek and Latin enthusiast, to kind of really pique my interest about how the world works and be quite philosophical about many issues. And what's really initially inspired me are the virtues of Stoicism. So it's about really cultivating wisdom, which I think is very important. And I think in terms of my career, it's always been this drive to search for the truth. And in order to embrace it, I think you need wisdom. It's also thinking about justice. I mean, there's social justice, but again, if you think of Stoic values, it's about doing the right thing, being a positive influence in society, and again, working in an industry which is now a fiduciary to people's savings. I think it ties up with that. And then courage in terms of having convictions and being able to endure pain and being able to make the difficult decisions. So I think I had a very firm grounding from my parents about this. And then at school, I took economics. That's around standard 10. And really sort of that opened my eyes to the broader economy. So you have microeconomics where, you know, one started to discuss consumer behavior, corporate behavior, which was fascinating to me because I was very far from the world of business, and macroeconomics, which is how the global economy functions. So that really started to direct my interest. And then where I started to really delve into markets was October 1987 crash. That's where I really started to kind of read about it and understand, you know, how the finance world was working.
Yeah, that was a big one. But where did you grow up? Because you studied extensively in the UK. Did you grow up there?
No, I grew up in Mauritius, but then after my matric, I went to the UK where I did most of my further studies, my undergrad, postgrad, and then chartered accountancy qualifications.
And that was during the 80s, that's when you started to study. And how did the winds of the world blow you to South Africa?
I think I did the opposite journey to most. Most people kind of at the time, at the dawn of democracy, a lot of people, I was working for PricewaterhouseCoopers, were coming to London on exchange. And for me, I thought South Africa offered much premise. I think it's also a little bit of my contrarian streak where everyone was trying to book a flight to London. I did the opposite journey in terms of the exchange program. So I went from London to Johannesburg, where I worked in the Pricewaterhouse office that was the Coopers merger, which is basically opposite Sandton City where Alexander Forbes is right now.
Yeah, interesting times. So let's talk about investments. You've referred to your first real exposure to investments, or where you first took note of it, was in 1987 with the big international crash. Of course, there have been many subsequent crashes, but just tell us, what were you doing and why were you so intrigued by this event?
I think there is much of an overlap between economics and the workings of the global economy and finance. So for me to see the vagaries of the market, I mean, at the time, the Dow Jones fell 23% on the day. That led me to focus and to try to understand what could drive such a big move in markets. And then when I went to university, I was lucky enough to get a scholarship to study at the London School of Economics. I focused my interest in financial economics, which is really the intersection of economics and finance. I was very privileged to be taught by a number of professors, which became very key figures in the world of central banking and finance. Most notably, one of my main lecturers in financial economics was Professor Mervyn King, who became the governor of the Bank of England and wrote a book on radical uncertainty. So that really formed my view about how the global economy and the banking sector and the central banks had an influence on how economies and finance evolved. So I was quite lucky to there be exposed to a number of key figures in the world of economics.
But the 87 crash was a big one. Did it not scare you off the investment world, because it was a major destructor of wealth in recent history?
Not really. I think when I was at varsity, I mean, this is where we studied, you know, what was the cause of that. Obviously, at the time, it was accelerated by basically computer-based selling of futures, whereby it was portfolio insurance which kicked in. And that helped me to understand really the vagaries of markets and what was driving markets away from fundamentals. But more importantly, I mean, I also saw the intersection between that and the roles of central banks in terms of monetary policy as well. So there again, I had a number of very influential professors, Professor Charles Goodhart, who wrote a lot of basically the founding documents for a number of central banks, namely the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, talking about how best to manage monetary policy. And he's got even got a law after him called Goodhart's Law, which talks about how the fact that governments rely on certain statistics to make decisions that leads to that being altered or ineffective. So for me, the key was understanding how central banking, finance, and the real economy interacted. And I was very privileged to be able to study that with some of the leading thinkers of the time.
Yeah, but that's the economics world, and it's a whole world in itself. But investments, obviously, you were interested in it. When did you make your very first investment, and what was it?
So I started at university. So it was an interesting time in the UK, because there was what they called not only the big bank deregulation of the financial industry, but also a number of privatizations at the time. So a number of companies like water companies, utilities, electricity companies, British Telecoms and the like, started listing, even building societies, went from mutuals to being listed. So that meant that there were a number of new companies which came to the stock exchange. So for me at university, with a number of friends, we started studying these company financial statements and investing the little money that we could spare, investing in the better of these companies. I mean, just to bear in mind, there probably was in a year, I mean, we're talking 8-9 water companies, because they each were in different regions and they keep coming to the market. Same things with the electricity companies. So each region had their own and they were listing. So that allowed us to study their financial statements and decide which one was the most sustainable. And then subsequent to that, a lot of these companies got taken over and consolidated, which also was a big driver of returns in those. So we did quite well from those.
Yeah, interesting choice of companies, because many young people won't go that route. They will rather invest in penny stocks or the companies they know really well, maybe companies they are clients of. So that is an interesting perspective. Did you ever build your own share portfolio or start to invest to build a portfolio when you were young?
My parents didn't have that type of money, and I didn't have that type of money when I was studying. What I did learn from that process, as I described, was really to go into things actually where there's not a lot of information, where you realize that companies can be mispriced simply because people don't pay attention and they don't spend the time understanding their financials. So for me, that was a clear lesson to, yes, you can go the route of very well-known brands, and we can talk about that now, which is more what I would prefer. But at the time, that taught me quite a big lesson in terms of that markets are not always efficient. They don't know how to price such companies. And if they are, you know, ignored by the mainstream of the market, you can make money by picking the right company with better fundamentals.
That is the traditional contrarian approach, where you buy companies that are cheap and hopefully they will normalize, or the share price will normalize in the future. Is that a minority approach? If you look at maybe other asset managers who may be more interested in growth and momentum stocks.
Yeah, look, I think at the time, if you think the 90s, 80s, 90s, I think value investing was still the prime style in the market. I think growth investing more recently has come into fashion after the global financial crisis, where interest rates from the developed world came to close to zero. And that's where growth investing really picked up. So at the time, value investing was the one method which had worked over the time. And obviously, at the time, I would read Benjamin Graham, the intelligent investor, who is really the father of value investing. And as you know, Warren Buffett was one of his students when I think I studied at Columbia. So that was the main, I would say, thrust and driver of my investment philosophy at the time.
If you could give advice to young professionals, I'm talking young as in mid-20s, early 30s, and they would like to follow a value-based approach, how do you think they should think about it and conceptualize a relevant strategy?
Yeah, I think investment, you can learn a lot in terms of reading the right books and understand what drives the market. So very much, I would say, start with a bottom-up philosophy. So value in investing, a lot has been written about it. I spoke about the intelligent investor as probably the primer for value investing. The other thing is also develop an understanding of financial statements and how to value companies. So that's also quite important to be able to understand, you know, the balance sheet of the company. Is it viable? Is it a company which maybe has too much debt? The cash flows of the companies, again, what are they generating? And then to be able to do a calculation of what the company is worth. So again, understanding how a DCF works or a PE valuation would be quite useful to start off. So very basic metrics. So not only, I would say, go by, you know, what the buzz is, but sometimes there are hidden gems where companies are not being looked at, and you can come across those, you know, sometimes by word of mouth, sometimes by interacting with them, and then do the work, understand what the financials look at. Is it viable? Is it profitable? Has the company been doing well, or is it just going through a bad patch and it will recover? That's where the opportunity often comes.
But it's a very methodical approach, very academic approach. And in many cases, to do these analyses you've referred to, you would need to be a CA or have extensive accounting experience. Do you think it's possible for a non-financial professional to also be successful?
I think a lot of data these days is available online. So instead of you doing the calculation, a lot of it is available online. A lot of it is also common sense. So understanding a company which is over-indebted versus a company which doesn't have debt. Also understanding the company's strategy. I think more often than not, one has to look at, is it a company which has got a long-term growth path, or a company which has got specific positioning in the market? Because if it's an overcrowded market where there's too much competition, it usually means that the competitive advantage would be eroded. So you do have to have a sense about a number of factors. The financial valuation is one thing, but I would say the industry structure and the competitive advantage of the company is also quite important, because when you invest, you're not investing for 1 year, 2 year. You're investing for a much longer term horizon, and that's what's incorporated in the price. So understanding that is important, and also kind of wondering what are the companies which are likely to do well long term is another one.
So your personal portfolio, what is your current approach to investing, and how do you invest currently and pick your assets and investment options?
I think as I've aged, I probably have quite a boring, level-headed approach to investing. So I can kind of think I want blue chip companies which are going to stand the test of time and are going to do well. So I'm not necessarily chasing the new thing or what's in favor. So I think hubris is very dangerous in markets, in the sense of people like to chase the latest story and it sounds very exciting, but often it's overpriced. My philosophy, and obviously it's been difficult, is I think the best opportunities is to invest is when markets are dislocated. So we saw that, for instance, in the COVID lockdowns, where market around the world sold off and a number of top class companies, household names, were just sold off 15-20% in a day. And for me, these are the best opportunities to invest, because whole industries will not disappear forever. At the time, I was thinking, for instance, even a share like Naspers, which relies a lot on gaming, I was surprised that it was sold off as aggressively, because you think there's lockdown and people will still game even more. Or if you talk globally, Amazon sold off during the lockdown, when you think, well, if there's a lockdown, you still need goods and services being provided, and a company relying on e-commerce would probably benefit from that. So I would tend to think when there is a severe sell-off in the market, this is where the best opportunities come through. And maybe again, you go back to the October 1987 crash, where I started to look at markets. That's influenced me a lot in terms of your starting point in market can make a huge difference to returns, and also avoiding investing at the top. So when markets have run very, very hard and are expensive, you know, one has to be careful to commit too much money to the market.
But your portfolio currently, are you preferring unit trusts? Do you still have a few direct investments? Do you maybe invest outside the equity markets?
I have a mix. I'm lucky enough to have a range of funds at Ashburton, which, you know, I believe in terms of the philosophy, which have done very well. So it's a mix. I tend to have a mix of funds which are more income orientated. Some of the equity funds are more racy. So our global equity funds has exposure to global markets. But again, the philosophy is one of investing towards blue chip companies, which have got sustainable returns, long-term and moats. And then our local equity fund, for instance, has got a number of SA Inc. smaller to mid-cap companies, which was quite contrarian, although I think after the GNU, they've come in favor. And I like that type of style of investing in companies which the market has completely ignored or didn't really favor. And that's where the big returns tend to be. So I find that I'm able to invest certain funds, and obviously I've got some stocks which I've invested in myself. But as I said, the bulk of a lot of the stocks I picked was in 2020. I've been less active directly in the market as the markets got more expensive.
Then just lastly, what has been your worst investment you have ever made? One which you do not really want to talk about?
Yes, it's a difficult one, but it's an obvious one. I mean, professionally and personally, my worst investment was Steinhoff. Looking back, obviously, it was one which, you know, we can look back and discuss, Rake, the balance sheet. And it had, looking back, all the characteristics of a company which, you know, one shouldn't touch. It's one where there was arrogance and hubris, which company which sued growth at all costs, obviously with a CEO who kind of wanted to buy anything that moved. And then even when we started to see signs, and there were a number of signs of investigations and the like, where German authorities investigated them as far back as 2015, and then they had a bit of a fallout with their partners. I think these were the early signs that things started to unravel, which I unfortunately didn't pay too much attention to, because again, I think at the time I was too focus on the broader growth story, like investing in a company which, you know, was expanding its footprint, not only out of South Africa into Europe, but also in the US. So that was a big mistake personally. Interestingly enough, in the funds that I used to manage, it was a big knock that year, so 2017. But 2018, we probably had the best year on record again. That's also a lesson. You take a big knock, you have to make a decision, you have to reassess where your investments are. And I think the next year, we made it all back. And in terms of 10-year track record, the equity funds that I used to manage still have some of the best track records ever. So I would say to the listeners, don't let something like this derail you. I think you need to keep focusing on investing on the right things. These things are black swan events, which you can't foresee, especially fraud. But as long as you make sound decisions year in, year out, and you avoid companies, you'll do well long term.
Yeah, you know, obviously you weren't alone. Dishonesty is a destructor of value, and it's not easy to pick up, especially not proactively. But then conversely, what is the best investment you have ever made?
I mean, rather than me, I think in terms I was lucky with the analysts that surrounded me. I think at Sanlam, we were very early in terms of our investment in Naspers. I think at the time, many people were skeptical about the value of Tencent and what it meant to be exposed there. So again, I would say boring, but it wasn't that fashionable when you look back 15 years ago to invest in Naspers, and the portfolios and clients did well, and I also did quite well out of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the 1990s, it was just a media company in South Africa. And I still remember I bought shares in Naspers when I was still at school. Unfortunately, I sold it at 45 Rand to buy a house, so an expensive house. But that was in the 1990s. But we'll have to leave it there. Patrice, thank you so much for your time today and for sharing your insights.
Pleasure, Ray.
That was Patrice Rasouis, the Chief Investment Officer at Ashburton Investments.
Show me the money.
That was the Money Web, Be a Better Investor podcast with Rake Funikap. Thanks for listening. Catch up and listen to all the Money Web podcasts on moneyweb.co.za or the app. Money Web, your trusted source for business and investment insights.